It was a real controversy. Ho Chi Minh City, September 19th, committed to a Vietnamese mental hospital for nearly a year after being diagnosed as delusional for believing in God. The Reverend Tran Van Trong was finally released to his family. He was a former officer in the Vietnamese People's Army. He was arrested in May of 2003 and imprisoned without charges for 9 months, which, by the way, we have in our Constitution here, speedy trial. That's why it was written into our Bill of Rights, which certain members of our administration are telling us is no longer important. Because you could arrest someone, don't bother to charge him, don't bother to try him, lock him away forever without ever bringing him to trial. No chance to defend yourself against the charges. He was arrested again in June of 2004, placed in a mental hospital when they were unable to charge him with any crimes. Initially, he was heavily injected with unknown drugs and became ill and lethargic, but a doctor at the hospital had told his wife that he showed no signs of any mental disorder. By the way, using mental disorder allegations was common in the former Soviet Union against dissidents. Anyone who would be crazy enough to believe in God would be considered mentally ill, to not recognize the wisdom of Marxism. In Vietnam again, local authorities on August 30th shut down a 500-member church. The church had sought a permit to meet since its inception 8 years ago. In India, a group of Hindu extremists attacked and beat 8 students from the Bersheba Bible College of the Indian Pentecostal Church of God. That was earlier in May. August 8, Hindu extremists began a campaign to reconvert Christians from Dalit backgrounds in the north-central Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. The World Hindu Council planned to convert to Hinduism at least 80,000 of the Dalits. They are the untouchable caste, the lowest caste in the caste system which exists in India. The World Hindu Council is claiming that 200,000 of these Dalits had converted to Christianity, and they're very upset about this because what Christianity gives them, what Hinduism cannot, is hope in this life and not having to go through a whole series of reincarnations. September 2nd, the World Hindu Council called for a comprehensive law to ban religious conversions in India as a part of a new campaign to stem the increasing number of conversions around the country. Closer to home, southern part of Mexico, on August 31st, Huichol native mobs in Jalisco State, that's a tribe, by the way, Huichol, have driven Christians from their homes and threatened to burn them to death, according to news reports. The first wave of 70 refugees from the village of Agua Fria fled on foot across the state border into Tepic, Nayarit, beginning on August 14th. The total of number of refugees was expected to reach more than 300. This has been an ongoing situation in southern Mexico, especially in the state of Chiapas, where basically the situation there is when native Mexicans who may come from Indian tribes or whatever source come to Christ, they begin to drop local customs because the local customs in Mexico are a mix of traditional Roman Catholicism with what were Native American belief, and Native American meaning the tribes that existed in Mexico at the time of the Spanish conquest. And so what they have is a blend, a syncretistic type of religion, which is not really Catholic. The bishops of Mexico have opposed this type of action. But what happens is when these people become Christians, they stop participating in a lot of the festivals that occur there that are rotating around religious and other issues. They stop getting drunk. They stop buying beer. They stop doing all sorts of things. And this threatens the income to the tribal chiefs who are called caciques. And so dozens and dozens and dozens of Christians have been driven from their homes and villages, and there's a real civil rights fight in Mexico going to try to enforce the rights of these Christians in the southern part of Mexico. Frequently when persecution starts, it's totally unexpected. It takes the church off guard. Diocletian, the last persecution of the church, was probably one of the most fierce. It was unexpected because everything had sort of settled down in the Roman Empire. The church had enjoyed 40 to 60 years of relative peace. Large numbers of the Roman military had come to belief in Christ. I think it was almost a third up to a half had become Christians, including the officers. And so everyone had assumed life was going to get better here in the empire when all of a sudden the persecution cut loose for political reasons we won't go into here in the Roman Empire. When the persecution comes quickly, people recognize what's happening and they can make decisions that have to be made. When it comes slowly, it's like mental morphine and it's like death by a thousand cuts, and Christians are more forced into some kind of compromise. When persecution comes, it never usually comes simply because people hate Christians. There are historical reasons, and they're almost always the same. There's nothing new under the sun, as Solomon tells us. Number one, they're persecuted because Christianity represents some kind of threat to the established power structure or the philosophies of government. So, for example, what Pastor Paul's doing here this morning is illegal in China. You can't talk about the second coming in China. The Chinese government prohibits that. Now, that doesn't stop the home churches, by the way. They go on and preach about it. But the reason is the Chinese government believes the future is in the new vision of Marxism that they have there, and they don't want anybody believing in some other kind of a type of life or hope or something else which would remove that vision. So that's why this came along. Two, Christianity collides with accepted worldviews of the culture. That's either religious or secular. In the West, it's a secular worldview. But every worldview makes exclusive claims about truth and on the hearts and minds of people. And it's in competition with any other worldview. So any worldview which tells you that it's totally inclusive really isn't, because it excludes those people who don't believe what it teaches. So, for example, here in the West, we have a thing called tolerance and diversity, which it sounds nice. Now, the Bible tells us we're supposed to love everyone, including our enemies. That's different from being inclusive in terms of what we can accept and not accept. No one accepts everything. No one believes everything. Someone who says to you, well, I don't believe that there's such a thing as absolute truth. The very first thing that you should ask them is, well, do you believe that absolutely? Because it's a self-negating proposition. And you always have to do this in love, remember. But if you really want to give them a run for their money, they say, well, if you absolutely believe that there is no absolute truth, then that absolutely means that there might be absolute truth, because you can't say that there isn't no absolute truth because you absolutely don't believe anything. So you have absolutely proven that there isn't anything such as absolute truth. Absolutely. All right. Go ahead. I challenge you to go back through that. And you don't have to feel bad. You can make it up as you go along, because it was a little different in the first service. So there it is. The third thing is Christianity impedes what others wish to do, and they resent it. People who say, well, I don't believe Christians should force their will on others. Well, for Pete's sake, what, do you advocate then that we shut down the state capitol in Boise or Olympia or the national capitol in Washington, or if you're listening in Canada, in Ottawa or wherever your national capital is? Because when these representatives, members of parliament, congressmen, whatever they are, go to these places of making law, they intend to push somebody's belief into public law on everybody. That's the whole nature of it. And so the question is not whose belief is going to be pushed. It's simply a question of which beliefs? That's what we're debating. But when people say that, they would have you believe that one side is pushing their belief and the other side isn't. If a person says, you shouldn't push your belief on me, then you say, well, why are you pushing that belief on me? See, they never think of that. The belief that you shouldn't push beliefs is a belief which they're now pushing on you. If you don't believe you should push your beliefs on other people, shut up. Let me push my beliefs. All right? See, they're not consistent. And these people that say this are, in all fairness, genuinely believe this until you just sort of take them a little further down the road. You're never doing this in hatred, all right? Try to avoid rancor. Now, once persecution sets in, see, I come from the East originally. I have a real sarcastic nature about me. Maybe it's part Jewish, part... But it's sort of like, all right, yeah, what do you want? You know? No, don't give me that. Once persecution sets in, Christians have an immediate issue. As I said, if it comes in gradually, it comes upon you like a death of a thousand cuts. If it comes suddenly, it's much more crystal clear in your mind. And that is, how far can you accept this new situation, fit in with it, and compromise, or where do you have to take a stand? It's important not to take stands at stupid locations. It's also important to realize how far you can or cannot go. And typically, a large group of Christians falls away almost immediately, or forms a compromise group. In Germany, this was true. The Third Reich came upon Germans suddenly. Now, it had been building for over a decade and a half. But when it finally snapped, it was very sudden. And pastors didn't know what to do. They were trying to figure this all out. Because, you see, the important thing is most persecutions are legal events. They're not just something sporadic. They're legal. The Third Reich, the Holocaust, was a legal event, legally determined by the legitimate ruling leaders of Germany at the time. Hitler was elected. And everything he did was legal, even to the suspension of their contract.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw with my co-host, Roy Avila.
Good evening.
Good evening, Michael.
And tonight we're going to have an interesting 2 hours. Our first hour is going to focus on central banking and trade and understanding how policy is made in the United States. Professor of Philosophy Steve Yates is back as our guest to discuss the emergence and rise to power of central banking and the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilaterals. What are the looming consequences of their successes? Well, Dr. Yates is going to review one very active phase of the New World Order construction, the New Trade Agreement era. It is time for Americans to understand the real purpose for regional trade agreements like NAFTA and organizations like the World Trade Organization. Dr. Yates is a philosopher in South Carolina, living in South Carolina. He's a professor at the University of South Carolina, upstate. He is an author of several books. His articles and reviews have appeared on lewrockwell.com as well as newswithviews.com. And if you go to our radio page tonight, you'll get a link to the News with Views articles that Stephen has published this year at that site. And he's been published in academic journals, many of them, over a period of time. Well, Stephen, are you with us?
I am here.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. It's back east where we're talking to you, and it's, gee whiz, 11 o'clock already down there. You guys sure do tire out a lot earlier than we do here on the West Coast.
Of course, I've been up since 3 a.m., your time.
Well, I wouldn't even conjure doing that, so you know, good for you. Although I was on a trip back east here a couple weeks ago, and I guess I did get up early a few times. You know, boy, I sure did see the signs of sustainable development down in Florida and up in Chicago. Boy, Chicago looked to me like it was ready for police state action.
Well, come to Greenville, South Carolina. There's all sorts of evidence of, there's all sorts of activity around here that has sustainable development written all over it. For example, there's a complex that is still in the planning stages, involves a major university, both state and federal government, and several major corporations, and they're putting in a wildlife habitat.
My, and to what benefit might that be?
What benefit?
Yes.
Well, they say it's going to create jobs, if that's the sort of benefit that you had in mind.
My, you know, I guess that fits right in with our local high schools that are training, you know, young children to be swamp masters rather than teaching them history and geography. You know, in that new world order, we're all going to be servants to the earth as directed by a ruling elite. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, is how the new system that is being devised by some desperate people is actually coming to pass right behind our very eyes. Well, Steve, I'd like to talk tonight about some of your work and study in the field of free trade, because free trade is clearly, so-called free trade, that is
yeah, clearly bringing free trade.
Yeah, it's clearly bringing us to the brink of something that Americans will not appreciate in the near future. We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. While some of our stations take a commercial break, with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates. So, tell us, to get us started here, we had Patrick Woods a couple weeks on the show, and he talked about the trilateralists. It's a very compelling story that he told, both in the context of the international financial system arranged under the Bank of International Settlements, and the Trilateralist Commission, which was set up by John D. Rockefeller in conjunction with...
You mean David Rockefeller.
David Rockefeller, excuse me. Along with how do you say Carter's National Security Advisor's name? I always have a tough time with that one. Zabrinsky?
I've been pronouncing it Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Oh, very good.
No, that's as close as I can come. That's...
Well, I think the listening audience will remember that name from a couple of decades past, because it was always in the news. But these two fellows formed up the Trilateralist Commission, an association between the United States, Europe, and Japan, to basically take the world into a new era of central control. And, you know, there's other factors behind that, and some of your writings have focused on the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, it all comes down today to the implementation of this globalist trade concept that really is breaking down our national borders. You wrote an article, in fact, entitled Erasing America, that was that's to be found at News with Views. Tell us what you mean by erasing America.
Well, what we are looking at is a very gradual process, gradual in sort of the Fabian socialist sense of gradual, that is maneuvering little by little to dissolve the borders, dissolve our border between Canada and the United States, and also dissolving the border between the United States and Mexico, so that they can treat North America as if it was a country instead of a continent. Now, I would recommend people to pay attention to major newspapers, major magazines, other sources of mainstream sources of information, to watch for usages of the phrase North America, as if it was a country instead of a continent. I've seen several instances of this.
Well, and that has some real applications. We'll get right back here to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. For the audience that has been apart from us for the last couple of minutes, what Stephen Yates is describing is the methodology for how America is being erased, and that in the broader context of these objectives is to erase the border between America and Canada, and erase the border between America and Mexico, so that we end up with North America, which we're hearing about quite a bit lately, the North American this or that. When you see that term, just be mindful that the internationalists are attempting to transfer the concept of America to this continental concept of North America. In other words, eliminating the remaining semblance of the constitutional doctrines that have guided this country for several centuries.
Yeah, this will leave the Constitution in limbo. But there's one document that seems to be the guiding document of this whole process, and that can be found on the Council on Foreign Relations website. It's called Building a North American Community. There's 47 pages of text there. That excludes acknowledgement and front matter and a few other things.
Well, let's step back and you say the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, it used to be that people thought that was made up and that it didn't exist. What is the Council on Foreign Relations, and why should we care that they've got a document that reads as you just described?
And who's on it?
The Council on Foreign Relations was formed in 1921 by a number of Rockefeller-type operators and a number of Fabian socialist types, chief among them this Colonel Edward Mandel House, who had been Woodrow Wilson's number one man. I believe it was formed following... At the time they called it the Great War. We call it World War One now, because there had already been an attempt to create an incipient world government in the form of a League of Nations, and that was torpedoed by the Senate. So they had to regroup and prepare themselves to eventually to make another attempt. So well, that other attempt became the United Nations eventually.
So every attempt causes a reseeding of objective. And a new flowering.
You're sort of like two steps forward, one step back.
Okay.
Because we're talking about a long process. It goes back decades here, and they've, like any other human endeavor, they're going to meet with setbacks.
Well,
but we're talking. Excuse me.
You suggest, or you state that it began in 1921.
Well, it didn't begin in 1920. The whole process we're talking about didn't begin in 1921, just the CFR.
The CFR. But now, that had been a secret organization for some period of time, was it not?
Well, semi-secret.
Okay.
I think... well, let's put it this way. Almost nobody knew about it until... I believe the first person to blow the whistle was a guy named Dan Smoot, who wrote a book, I think it was either in the late 50s or early 1960s. I don't own a copy of it myself. I've just seen it. And then, of course, Carol Quigley, who was the professor at Georgetown University, was the first figure to blow the whistle on it that nobody could ignore. Because after all, he was right at the center of things.
And today, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is very open and very public. You find them, you find some of their sessions actually telecast on C-SPAN. Is that true?
That's true. They have a huge website in which all you have to do is sign up, get your user ID and your password, and you can begin nosing around, and you will find articles on there like Richard Gardner's. Are a famous infamous, depending on your point of view, 1973 article about the hard road to a new order, which speaks openly about the end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece. That's not an exact quote, but that's close.
Well, that's a typical Fabian methodology. Move slowly like the turtle and just grab piece by piece the institutions of liberty and subvert them to the new order that centralizes all power and authority.
Yes, and we're seeing the same thing with this building a North American community. We will just see a very subtle movement towards treating North America like it was a country instead of like a continent. It's kind of my way of putting it.
Well, and of course we've had that example shown to us in Europe, and of course,
the European Union is sort of the prototype for this process. They're ahead of us on the curve for I'm not sure exactly 10 years or so. That's a rough guess, but there's also along the same lines, I also discussed this in Erasing America, the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America.
Well, that certainly sounds good. Security and prosperity, a partnership for North America. I mean, gee, what
okay,
could be wrong
it sounds
with that?
Good. But these people are really good with language, because what they really want to do is create a regional authority that would stand over all three formerly sovereign nations.
And where would the power for that regional authority come from?
Do you mean the financial power, or?
Well, how does it get itself? I mean, most Americans would sit there and say, ah, there's no way Mexico and Canada become part of the United States by decree, where all of our resources get funneled out to those countries in order to build their defense system to our standards and drain America of its resources in so many ways. Most Americans would say, that's not even possible.
Well, I would say that it's already happening, at least in the case of Mexico. And the our border with Mexico is so porous now that it's difficult to say that the process isn't already in motion.
Of course, then,
in that case.
Then you've got the President of the United States just recently coming out saying he's going to clamp down on the border and protect the American institutions. So again, the naysayer to this dynamic is going to say, oh, this isn't going to happen because we're wary of that. And when it goes, when it goes along the route, walls are put up and America will stay independent. What would you say to a person who argued as such?
Well, here's what you would have to do is forget all about what people are saying. Forget all about what President Bush is saying and just watch what he is doing. What really is being done to protect our borders, including even from potential terrorists. Nothing.
Well, let's now turn that same focus to the area of trade, because one subtlety that can pass over many people is the notion that trade policy is what really sets up the nationality for a country. Without a country's capacity to establish its trade policy, it really has no border on that counts, the political economics of this system. How is it that trade policy is being affected by this this whole process that we're describing tonight?
Well, this process at least has part of its roots in this whole NAFTA process. Of course, NAFTA went online, so to speak, at the beginning of 1994. And this is kind of flowing from that in many respects. Also, the WTO, although NAFTA was an agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So,
and so, what is the WTO, or the World Trade Organization
have
to do with NAFTA?
Well, they're both bilateral agreements, or they both follow from bilateral arrangements. And ultimately, this ties in with the UN and support for the UN Charter, and the long-term goal, first of all, creating regional governance, as I think they would like to call it. Well, a regional economic integration is the term that they prefer. Now that I think about it, so what they're promoting is regional, economic integration.
So the world
you can actually find that on the website for NAFTA, for CAFTA, and so on. And the WTO website doesn't speak so much of free trade as it just does of trade.
And then if we were to, are you suggesting then that the globalist political organizations like the United Nations or the World Trade Organization are seeking to regionalize economics in various sectors of the world, irrespective of national boundaries? Is that their goal?
That's the goal. Eventually, the long-term goal then to eventually dissolve national borders. Of course, to get going, tying back into some of the things that Brzezinski has written about, I had his book here, Between Two Ages, came out in 1969, which gives you an idea here. And that book basically describes the nation state, as the term he uses, as if it were obsolete and needs to be transcended.
And he was the national security advisor for
Jimmy Carter.
For Jimmy Carter. So there's a, you know, we talked about Wendell House in the Wilson administration, and now Brzezinski and the Carter. It seems that our presidential administrations, from one decade to the next, are imbued with these folks who have a different vision for America's future. We'll be right back at the 421 Santa Cruz Radio Show in just a moment.
As a listener, policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and Earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy, at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Environmental apocalypse, that sure is as high as blue.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw here with Roy Avila, and our guest tonight is Steve Yates. And Steve, I'm reading from one of your essays that, quote, the plan, and that's what we're talking about here, is the globalist political and economic plan, is to have the super elite's North American community in place by the year 2010. And here is what they want. One, military and law enforcement cooperation between all three, that's Mexico, the United States, and Canada, eventually to be dissolved nations. Two, Canadians and Mexicans brought into the American Department of Homeland Security. And three, the temporary migrant worker programs expanded with full mobility of labor between the three countries in the next 5 years. Well, with those dynamics, the whole contour of American society would be changed, and the whole concept of a nation would be ended. Is that true?
That's basically true, because we're looking at a long-term assault on America's middle class, which would probably not be able to survive all of these changes. Yeah, if we're too expensive.
Well,
it's
clear from other sustainable development documents that the purpose of sustainable development is to eliminate the American middle class. And this is one of the methodologies for doing that, and that and more, because not only would our middle class be eliminated, but our ability to create the conditions for a national rebound would be lost, because our authority over our own lives would have been lost and given over to this globalist governance dynamic.
Yes, we're already so tied down with bureaucratic type of rules and regulations. Now, businesses here are so throttled with regulations already that's one of the factors that's is sending jobs overseas and to other nations that don't have these regulations.
Well, let's talk a bit about public-private partnerships in this context, because it seems to me that all these dynamics are really fitting together, and that those who are thrusting for this new world order understand these to be pieces of one pie, the pie that they're going to shove down the throats of the American society.
Well, yeah. Now there's a quote from Mussolini that I have around here somewhere, who addresses an issue that's definitely pertinent to this, where he claims, I can't quote it exactly because I can't find it, but he says in effect that fascism really ought to be called corporatism, because that's what it really is the coming together of government power and business power, the political power of government and the economic power of business. You combine them together and you've got a very powerful force.
Well, I always say
it literally takes over.
I always say it's the force of government combining with the power of business.
That'll do.
And that is what public-private partnerships are. That is what third-way economics are. That's what neocons are all about. And that's what the New World Order is seeking to strive to deliver to us. Whether we're from the left or the right, the political leaders on both sides work to combine to bring us to that global corporate socialist dynamic.
Well, that's exactly right. Of course, as a trained philosopher, one of the things that I notice, it just leaps out at me, is certain words. And one of the most common that I see in this context is either this word partnership or partner, or the treatment of partnering is like a verb. I don't recall seeing that even 10 years ago. But today it's everywhere. Everybody is partnering with everybody else.
Well, 10 years ago, the concept of sustainable development would have
it was still in its infancy.
Now
it's everywhere.
Right, but that's the overall social political dynamic, and the economic force behind it is the regionalization of trade agreements that are then mandated by global governance organizations, and the combination of the favored businesses with the force of government in these so-called public-private partnership dynamics.
True. It's interesting you use the phrase favored business because we're talking about arrangements here, the specific kinds of arrangements between business and government. If you're not one of the favors, you're not going to get anywhere.
Well, that's right, and that's where the whole concept of global to local becomes so pertinent, both in the state of Iowa, which is where this term came up, was devised, and here in Santa Cruz County back in the 80s, it was the global to local partner, global to local bumper stickers, and that global to local concept of public-private partnerships is now flying through the country, because I don't care where you are, the corruption of local public-private partnerships is just running rampant. And with that, we're going to be back here in a little while with our special guest, Dr. Stephen Yates, while we discuss central banking and trade and understanding how policy is being made in the year 2005 here in the United States. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're going to talk right through the advertising break that some of our stations are going to take with our guest, Stephen Yates. Steve, let's talk about central banking and how that plays into the trade dynamic and the public partnership dynamic and how it all tends to fit together.
Sure. First of all, I would recommend that anyone listening who doesn't have this book, by all means, get it at your earliest opportunity. It's a book that I've cited in a number of my articles. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island, by G. Edward Griffith. And he really gives a thorough history of the entire thing and a clear explanation, which I've been drawing on ever since first encountering it. It's just plain a fantastic piece of work.
And so how does central banking take control over policy establishment or trade dynamics and ultimately the sovereignty of the nation itself?
Well, ultimately, now we have to go back centuries. It's not clear to me who, you have to move from banking itself to the concept known as fractional reserve banking, because that's the key right there. There's nothing wrong with banking originally as an enterprise. There's now the first bankers began just by storing precious metals for customers for a fee, and then they issued their customers a certificate. And that certificate just became the ancestor, one might say, of a paper currency. Now, it was understood at the time that the locus of value was the gold, not the paper currency. And so the paper currency was just a certificate that indicated that a certain amount of gold was in the bank on deposit.
Being held for
sort of being held in escrow, I guess. I think that's the right word.
Okay.
And those certificates became the first currency. Then the bankers noticed something interesting. They noticed that, these certificates are much easier to carry around than a bag of gold coins. Gold's pretty heavy, after all. So, most customers left all their gold in the bank. And actual withdrawals, I think the measure was around 10% that they might need to withdraw. So they could use the certificates to issue loans.
Excuse me there. We're back. Some of our stations have returned at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, and our guest, Stephen Yates, is explaining how fractional reserve works in the context of central banking. In other words, what does the paper that you pass around as money mean, and what did it used to mean, and how have these dynamics changed over time? So continue for us, Steve.
Well, the certificate was not actually considered money. Gold, that was really what was money. And obviously a bag of gold is harder to carry around than a certificate. So the certificates became popular. They became the first currency. And then the bankers noticed that customers usually left their gold in the bank. Actual withdrawals never exceeded around 10%. So the bankers reasoned that if they could that they could use certificates to issue loans as well as store coins. And so you get the beginning of investment banking with that. Now, I'll give you a quote here from G. Edward Griffin, from A Creature from Jekyll Island. They, meaning the bankers, said it was a pity for all that coin to just sit idle in their vaults. Why not lend it out and earn a profit, which then could be split between themselves and their depositors, put it to work instead of merely gathering dust? End of quote. So, seemingly they could, given that most of the gold just sat there, it seems safe to write certificates loaning out 80 or 90%. And then charging the recipients a fee, which became interest. So, what just happened? They discovered how to create money, quote unquote, out of thin air. They did discover fractional reserve banking, or at least the beginnings of it.
Which means that for every value of gold, there might be 10 times that amount issued in certificates by the bank to the customers.
Yeah, that's true. And I've got an even better illustration here, because this is one I constructed in an effort to explain fractional reserve banking to someone with without much experience at understanding. It's to understand where the financing for the New World Order originally came from, we must master this concept. We must understand how they learn how to create money out of thin air. Suppose, here's the illustration. Suppose we're playing poker at, let's call him Paul, at his house, and Paul's the banker. Now, let's suppose there's 7 of us. Let's suppose that each of the 7 of us has given Paul $20 in exchange for X number of poker chips, doesn't matter how many. So since there's 7 of us and each of us has given Paul a crisp $20 bill, his cash box contains how much? Just simple arithmetic, $140. Now it's presumed that any of us can leave this game anytime we want and exchange each of our poker chips for a dollar.
After all, it's $140 worth of poker chips, and there's $140 in cash in the bank.
Yeah, the two match, so there's no fractional element here yet. But we're enjoying the game, so we stay. The $40 stays in the box. Now the poker chips are functioning as the equivalent of backed currency in our illustration, and the dollars are functioning the same way gold functioned in our earlier illustration. Now let's suppose Paul's brother Peter shows up, and Peter wants to borrow some money. Now suppose Paul lends him $120 out of the box. He started with $140. Suppose Paul lends him $120. Now strictly speaking, Paul has no right to lend out that money. It's not his. It belongs to the people who to the 7 of us who put it in there. Now, he cannot lend out that 120 and still consider the poker chips to have the same value that they originally had. Now, let's suppose that he loans out the 120 anyway. Once he's done that, how much money are we really talking about? We are talking about not 140, but rather 140 plus 120, which equals 260.
So we've just made some money, huh?
So we've debauched the value of the poker chips, is what it amounts to.
Well, so long as nobody ever cashes out of the game, you know, you just almost doubled the amount of money in supply.
Yeah, you doubled what's out there floating around. So what it amounts to is the other 120, the 120 that Paul loaned Peter has been created ex nihilo out of thin air.
And
in other words, the poker chips, of course, are still being accepted and used normally, but they've become fractional money. The worth behind them is just a fraction of their face value. That's where the fractional comes in.
So the problem comes in when the clock turns 2 o'clock and everybody decides it's long enough, they've got to get up in the morning, and they turn to the bank and with their $140 of consolidated chips and try to get their money back. There's nothing there.
Well, if the banker can't return their money and he has no other protection, he's out of business. And banks did go out of business. But that's when they, if I may use the word, begin to partner with government in order to get protection. Because the investment bankers learned that they could loan money to governments in exchange for favors, and then continue to loan money, and then extend the loans and place conditions on that. Now
that's beginning to sound rather seedy.
You could look at it that way. Now the House of Rothschild got its start this way. M.A. Rothschild, back in the late 1700s, well, between 1760 and in the early 1800s, became a master at doing this. He became extremely wealthy, and it's gradually becoming clear as we study this, that the Rothschilds basically owned Europe by the middle of the 1800s. By that, the M.A. Rothschild, the first one, had 5 sons. Each of them opened a central bank in a different city in Europe, and they cooperated closely together. So globalism, or the equivalent of the 18th century equivalent, one might say, just became a natural process.
Well, the infrastructure for establishing what's come to be the European Union and the loss of autonomy by European countries was seeded by this banking arrangement several hundred years ago, is what you're telling us.
I have a question, though.
Yes, sir.
Where's all the gold, and how does this system affect you and I today?
Well, that's the question of the day, isn't it, Steve? Where is the gold?
Well, the gold is still there. It hasn't changed.
But it's in the hands of the Federal Reserve, isn't it?
Well, who owns the gold?
Well, it's not really clear. The point is, it's no longer owned by the borrowers. Because the long-term fate of a society that begins down this road is that the amount of currency in circulation, that's what we have to focus on, is the amount of currency in circulation continues to increase. The temptation, just psychological temptations of easy money, get stronger. As a result, there's more and more currency. Its actual worth is less and less. And eventually, we went off the gold standard altogether. The situation today, well, the Bush administration, the largest spending administration in history, they're spending more wealth than probably exists in the entire world.
Well,
measure of that wealth is actually gold.
Well, they've got to rebuild New Orleans with public-private partners. That means it's public money and their buddies getting the profits out of a rebuild situation. And we're seeing that everywhere. You don't have to be flood damaged to have public-private partnerships coming into your community.
Oh, no, we got them here.
Yeah. I would venture to say that every listener to this show is living in a county with massive federal-driven public-private partnerships forming up or taking effect now in your town. So the reason to understand the nature of the financial system that has been built and how it's being leveraged to advantage insiders to the exclusion of free enterprise and to ordinary people is something that is becoming increasingly important. Well, Steve, can you comment on how it is that organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations and the central bankers, the trilateralists included, perhaps, combine in order to create America's policies, which one can readily argue are not in the interest of the American people?
Well, of course, one thing they do is serve on overlapping boards of directors of big foundations, as well as if you look at the administration, at any recent presidential administration, all the way back as far as there's been a CFR, you will find that it's loaded with CFR members. And, of course, the Trilateral Commission was created in, I think, 1971. Don't hold me to that. It might have been 72, but, well, anyway. Well, the Carter administration was all trilateralists. And you have Ronald Reagan is the only recent president I can think of. Well, I don't think George W. Bush is a member, but just those two were all CFR members. And I think John F. Kennedy said that he was a member. I'm not sure his name appeared on the list for that time, so that one's a question mark. But Reagan was not a member, but his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, was a member, and also a trilateralist as well. So it's...
So the influence has been
presidential administrations, many leading members of Congress, many members of the media, many members in academia, including university presidents, and people in positions of authority and large multinational corporations. In fact, there's a total of something like 4,000 CFR members, and while nobody in his right mind really believes that all 4,000 of those are conspiring to rule the world, there's an inner circle that certainly is, so to speak.
Well, you know, if it's only so to speak, we wouldn't have the circumstances that we're facing in the world today. You know, we get regular interviews coming from England, and that dynamic with the European Union and the same regionalization of England, United Kingdom, and Europe generally is happening there at a faster clip than what it's happening here in North America. And boy, you know, we have a video that you can find at our e-commerce section called Who Rules Britain, and the shocking evidence coming from British experts on this field is that Britain no longer makes the rules for Britain. Brussels makes the rules for Britain, and Tony Blair is deeply involved in causing that to happen. And yet most English people don't understand that their prime minister is set whole hog for the dawning of this new globalist era. And I suspect that our president, past and present, are of the same ilk.
Yes, I would agree. The first George Bush, best known for his remarks where he openly used the phrase New World Order, and I think everybody at the time thought that that he and his immediate associates had coined the phrase, although it goes way back. It's the phrase has been used to refer to a kind of a secular corporate socialist empire type global structure for decades. H.G. Wells wrote a book, I think back in the 1930s, called The New World Order. So it's not a new concept at all.
Well, it's Wells is another Fabian, and we find the Fabian
yes
reference to the New World Order going back 125 years.
Let's see. And you mentioned Tony Blair. Either is or was a president of the Fabian Society, wasn't he?
Yes.
Isn't he?
Yes. Past chairman of the British Fabian Socialist Society.
And I've encountered authors who think that it's the Fabians that are at the core of the whole thing.
Well, we could say that the ideology and the practice of Fabians, as they express it themselves, has been very successful. You can objectively look around and see this ideology of a justice system that centralizes authority and makes people compliant or law violators and an economic system that requires you be a partner with the force, so you don't get to be a player in the economic system, as being core Fabian concepts. And, gee, look around the world today, that's what you see happening here, there, and everywhere. And for 100 years, their mission has been to permeate the concepts
permeate and penetrate
right throughout the world, and they have been successful at doing that. And their strategy oftentimes is to delay and just get compromised, because if they can get compromised from a local community over their land grab, or compromise over some other aspect of a corporate socialist system, well, they've won. Because once you've compromised the principle, it's only a matter of the price you're going to pay for that compromise. And, of course, that price keeps going up more and more as further compromises in this delaying tactic are further implemented. So the field laid out by the Fabians consistently for a long time now is something you can really see beginning to come into place as the new millennium began, particularly.
Sure. Now, one of the more interesting concepts one of the more interesting strategies that they've been using is tied with this notion of gradualism. They never do anything in a hurry. They never seem to be in a hurry. So if they can't get that compromise that you mentioned today, they'll just wait and they'll get it tomorrow. And in the meantime, the infiltration and penetration is linguistic. So they will start using North America as if it refers to a country instead of a continent. And they will start using the term partner and partnership and partnering and things like that. People will get familiar with it. It just becomes part of the background, just part of the ambience of culture. If they're used to it, they're not threatened by it.
Well, and I think, too, you're going to some of the things that you said and that we talked about earlier, where in the one piece it says Canadians and Mexicans being brought into American Departments of Homeland Security and the temporary migrant worker program, that is exactly what Bush said today. I'm going to close the borders, but I want a program. I want a
that's a compromise.
Program.
Yeah.
Yeah, and delay the final fall of the erasing of America. Steve, you've written a lot on trade agreements, NAFTA and CAFTA, and the next one, the Free Trade of the Americas. Tell us how that and the enforcement of those agreements through the World Trade Organization really works as an assault on American independence.
Well, what they do, each of these agreements and the WTO, they set up these tribunals. And these tribunals can overrule decisions made in America, including American court decisions, including in principle, I don't know that this has happened yet, but it could happen in principle, even Supreme Court decisions. So that's how it becomes a direct assault on American sovereignty.
And how are we going to see these things come down for the non-trained ear when we hear it in the news or read it in the newspaper? How, when we've seen NAFTA, we've seen CAFTA,
of course, I'm afraid that the untrained ear, well, just wouldn't hear it. In fact, that's the whole problem, is you practically have to shout this from the rooftops, because most people have been so conditioned not to even think about these kinds of issues. Now, you've been reading from my latest News with Views article, Erasing America. It has dawned on me since writing and submitting and seeing that published, it only tells half the story. The other half of the story is going to have to be a separate article. Currently in the thinking stage is called something along the lines of Erasing the American Mind, which looks at how our educational system is tied up with this whole notion of educating for sustainability, educating for workforce investment, educating for feeling good about ourselves. Everything except history, logic, things like that really keep people alert, tell them what to look for and listen for.
Well, it's been said on this show before that the educational system is being transformed from one of information, facts, and knowledge into one of attitudes, values, and beliefs. Because, you know, at the end of the day, if we're going to live in this Comtean society run by Fabian socialist mentality, we've all got to become compliant to their wish, or we're simply deemed not to be sustainable. And so that's why the push to mind control has become so heavy, and that's why political correctness has to be successful if this new globalist mentality is to really take over our future.
You know, notice how we are all now human resources or human capital, not human beings. That implies all too much autonomy.
Well, that's right. You know,
and I think the attack on the middle class ties in here. I don't know that they went after the middle class just as an end in itself, but the middle class mindset values financial independence. This is what the globalists don't want. They want people to be dependent.
Well, it's confusion, division, and dependency in order to set up a stage where we can have permanent revolution, war, revolution, and terror, just tearing us apart at every thread so that we're all coming to the globalist government for protection and approval.
Yeah, so it's sort of the creation of a corporate system that will, because it's already collectivist, will evolve naturally into the sort of socialism that they want.
Well, I like to think about it.
Well, evolve naturally. I'm uncomfortable with using the word naturally there, but it would evolve into it.
Well, I like from one of your other articles, you know, they do all this stuff. We always talk about this show, how it impacts every part of our lives, but they keep us involved in the matrix. So they can do what they're doing behind the scenes.
You know, the real matrix, as I call it, and I have a book in progress with that title, the contrast between what's going on in the matrix, which is this interactive dream world, which is that's created by the mainstream media and the educational system.
And the public-private partnerships.
And public-private partnerships and that whole arena versus the desert of the real, a term from the movie, of course. But in the Matrix, of course, everything's under control, and the Federal Reserve has inflation under control, and everything is sustainable, and the schools educate, and so on and so forth. In the desert of the real, of course, we're producing mass illiteracy. The schools here barely educate, and it seems clear that if there's anything that's not sustainable in the long run, it's continuing to print more money indefinitely. Because eventually, foreign investors are going to withdraw support from the dollar, and if that happens, the system crashes and burns.
Well, and at that point, we've bound ourselves to these trade agreements that prevent us from climbing off the canvas and putting ourselves back together. That's why the concept of sovereignty, especially when you're operating under the principles that are mankind's greatest achievement, which are embodied in the Declaration of Independence, become so important that we not abandon that to globalist trade policies and globalist financial dynamics that will leave Americans just flat on their back when or if something goes wrong.
I would agree that a healthy economy grows the food that it needs and manufactures what it needs. It doesn't import, it doesn't rely almost exclusively on imports. Since NAFTA went into effect, our trade deficit with Canada and Mexico has just skyrocketed. In fact, I have here an article from the Economic Policy Institute. It appeared on July 20th. Of this year, there has been a displacement of 1,015,291 U.S. jobs.
My.
Since NAFTA was signed in 1993.
Well, Steve, this hour has just whizzed by, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight, and look forward to the next time, and I look forward to seeing your next articles and news reviews. They've been marvelous.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Great. We'll be right back for the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
Go.
Yeah, different hour this time.
He's so damn smart, that dude.
Huh?
He's so smart.
So is that? Yeah. He has some folks who, you know, there's a Steve Yates fan club out there.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Hour of this evening's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, the host, and with my co-host Roy Avila. And the second hour, we're going to do something a little different from what we've typically engaged in. We're not going to talk about sustainable development directly. We're going to talk about a question that popped up into my head, Roy, oh, some while ago. And, you know, in some of the earliest speeches I gave, I'd always talk about the four conditions for creating a collective estate. And I would say one of those conditions was the ability to have a military structure that could control the world. You know, to have a global system, you've got to have a global military capacity. And I said in those talks, I would always say, gee, if America fell into the wrong hands, we certainly have that scientific capacity. And what a terrible thing to subject the world to a single military capacity that had the ability to control everything that everyone did. And so as things have run along for the last couple of years, I thought, gee whiz, what is the scientific capacity to modify weather? Because if we were being held in the wrong hands, if we were being misdirected by our leaders, or if the globalists assumed control with their tyrannical agenda, gee whiz, I said, what would be the potential for using weather for warfare? Does technology exist that could be used to perpetuate war and lead to the collapse of the American Republic? Well, tonight's guest is going to shed some light on that.
Well, the one thing I'll say before we get going, no matter what we talk about, sustainable development always comes up.
Well, there's no doubt about that, because that is the policy that is coming out of our federal government being reflected in the globalist agenda, and you'd see it everywhere. So I'm sure it will have, we'll get that tie-in. But our guest tonight is author Jerry Smith. Jerry, are you with us?
I am indeed.
Well, it's good to hear your voice, and we're looking forward to the information that you're going to be able to provide us and our listeners tonight.
I will try.
Good. Well, why don't we start with some description of what we're going to talk about and how it is that you've come to take an interest in focusing on these issues.
Well, cool. Where do you want to start?
Well, why don't we start with an overview of how it is that weather could be used for warfare.
Okay, that's a good one. Let me suggest that your listeners note a few things down as we talk, and then look them up. So I'm going to suggest a number of things they can do Googles on and find out that what I'm talking about is real. I guess I'll start with a U.S. Air Force position paper called "Owning the Weather." Let me start again. That weather as a force multiplier, owning the weather in 2025. Back at the mid-90s, the early 90s, the Secretary of the Air Force tasked one of the Air Force think tanks to come up with what it would take for the United States Air Force to be the dominant air and space power by the year 2025. And so there were some 41 position papers prepared by an Air Force think tank. And so these are all the papers are on the web. It's something like 3,700 pages altogether. One of them is Owning the Weather in 2025, which is very much discussed. And it proposes ways around the United Nations Environmental Modification Treaty, and that's probably out of mention. You can find the text of the UNMOD Treaty. It's the Convention on the Prohibition of Hostile Use of Environmental Modification. I forget exactly how the title goes. I'm sure if you just type in UNMOD, E-N-M-O-D, you'll get it. The UNMOD Treaty was negotiated. It started off, oddly enough, in the U.S. Senate. Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island got a wild hair that the military was developing weather weapons, and that if we allowed the military to go forward with this technology, it would unleash a great demon in the world. He convinced the Russians to jump on board, and the U.S. and USSR collectively hammered their various allies into agreeing, and I believe the UNMOD Treaty was signed into law either in 76 or 78. And it has no teeth. It has an enforcement procedure that is a joke at best, in which a nation that feels it has been violated has to go to the Secretary General and request that he brings it to the General Assembly, who then vote on whether to send it to the Security Council, who then vote on whether to do anything about it. It's absurd.
Has any action ever been brought under the...
No, exactly. First of all, you have to get the idea that environmental modification was used against you in a hostile manner by a military force, and breaks the provisions of the treaty. The provisions of the treaty are you cannot do things that are widespread, long term, and one other provision. I haven't looked at the treaty for a year or so, so I'm a little vague. There's a really great organization called the Sunshine Project, and the Sunshine Project is a very good analysis of what's wrong with the world military on a number of levels. And one of the things that the Sunshine Project looked into at great length and depth is the UNMOD Treaty and its failure. And there are a number of times that it appears to have been violated, but no nation has had the gumption to come forward and do anything about it. One example of this is Kosovo. When when NATO went into Kosovo, 96, 98, It was the rainy season, and the NATO bombers were having trouble targeting where their bombs were supposed to go because of all the cloud cover. So NATO firebombed the middle atmosphere in the stratosphere, at the top of the troposphere where weather takes place. They set off a series of thermobaric devices, your basic fuel air device that generates heat similar to an atomic bomb without the radiation. Jumped up the temperature by about 20,000 degrees and cleared out all that nasty moisture and made all the clouds go away. Unfortunately, the clouds never came back. 10 years later, it still hadn't rained in Kosovo.
My, that's not a story you read in the Associated Press.
No, it's not. No, you can find it on the web, though. I've only been able to find a couple of places where it's in English. It's an Eastern European problem, and so it doesn't migrate in English very commonly. Let me back up to nail down some of the history of military use of weather. The military doesn't let us know. The military keeps this secret because they are afraid of litigation. They're afraid of being tried. One of the problems that's going on right now in weather modification, in commercial applications of weather modification, there's a tremendous amount of weather applications going on right now. A lot of private industries are doing it. And there is the problem that you could be sued by somebody who thinks they've been harmed. And the first example, the military massively screwing up on this, was called Project Cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S. Project Cirrus was 1949. There was a hurricane, I think a Category 1 hurricane, off the coast in the Gulf, off of Savannah. It was off of Savannah, Georgia, and on the Atlantic coast, off of Savannah, Georgia, and it was sort of slowly drifting out to sea, and the Army wanted to see if they could do something with it, and they dropped 80 pounds of silver iodine into it, and within 45 minutes of they're dropping this, the hurricane did an abrupt turn and headed into land, killed one person, left 1,400 homeless, and the military flipped. The military were afraid that they would be sued by the citizens, and so they slapped it under a secrecy ban, and it didn't come out for like the next 25 years until it got declassified. During the Vietnam War, there was Project Popeye. Project Popeye was an attempt to turn the Ho Chi Minh Trail into an impassable quagmire of mud by feeding the clouds over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They tried to get it to rain day and night, for the entire year. They were somewhat successful. Not terrifically successful, but they definitely did have an impact on the region's weather. When it came out, a newspaper columnist broke the story, and the Army immediately denied they were doing it and changed the name of the project. So a year and a half, 2 years later, the project under the new name came out. And they said, no, we're sorry, we'll stop. And then officially, after the end of the war, the Department of Defense stated that they had absolutely zero interest in weather modification, and they were never going to spend another dime on weather modification. And yet, virtually every year, if you search the U.S. budget, you'll find between $12 and $30 million earmarked specifically for weather modification projects.
Wow. I have some recall of Lyndon Johnson back in the 50s when he was Senate Minority Leader as having made a statement. You may know this quote. A statement about he who He who controls the weather will control the wars of the future.
That's very true. That's very true. War and weather have gone together since day one. There are so many factors involved in a battle in weather. Remember D-Day, World War II. The fleet snuck up on the Germans under cover of a storm. And at the same time, they were desperately afraid that if the storm went against them, they could lose everybody. I mean, those amphibious landing craft could not deal with storm, and the whole army would drown. A few years earlier, the attack on Pearl Harbor came with the undercloak of a storm. The Japanese pilots used an incoming storm front to hide the incoming plane.
My. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Mr. Jerry Smith, you can call us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Well, Jerry, tell us then what kind of weaponry either is or could or will be available to agents now or in the foreseeable future?
That actually is a very difficult question for me personally, because I'm not an engineer, I'm not a scientist, I'm a professional writer. That's all I do is I know how to assemble sentences and paragraphs, and I have no clue how to build a weapon of any sort. You may know I wrote the book Hearts, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, which springboards from the Heart Project in Alaska. And I cover as little of the science as I can to be able to talk about the broader issues. I know the politics of weather manipulation. I don't so much know the technology of weather manipulation. And what I do know about it, mostly I don't understand. You know, I can parrot some of the words and phrases, but I have no idea what they mean.
Okay, well then let's talk a little bit about HAARP, and then talk about the politics of weather manipulation as it exists today.
Okay, HAARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. When completed, it will be the world's largest radio broadcasting station, but it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It is designed to inject radio frequency energy into a spot at the top of the atmosphere. And the current plans for it are to inject 3.6 billion watts, which is 72,000 times the amount of energy produced by one large 50,000 watt radio station, and put it into a spot that is about 2.5 miles deep by about 12 miles across by 50 to 90 miles up. Now, what this is intended to do is it will heat that portion of the atmosphere by several thousand degrees. When you do that, it literally blows the molecules of the atmosphere apart, and that creates a number of effects. HAARP is a type of device called an ionospheric heater because it heats the ionosphere. It is both one of a class and one of a kind. There are about 20 or 30 other ionospheric heaters on the planet. There's like six in the former Soviet Union. There's one in Norway. There's one at Arecibo in Puerto Rico. There's another second smaller one in Alaska called High Pass. The thing that makes HAARP different is it's the only one that can focus the output. It is what is called a phased array, which is a field of antennas that are so linked together as to work as one big antenna, and they can sequence the firing of the individual antennas in the field so as to focus the energy coming out. This is a unique patented ability, and only the holders of the patent get the contract. And there's a great deal of controversy and evidence about that, and I'll get into that if I can. This injecting energy into the top of the atmosphere to make it do things is called ionospheric enhancement. You gotta love the military. Only the military would think that breaking something makes it better. By injecting all this energy into the atmosphere, literally blows it apart, which one creates a stream of extremely low frequency radio waves called ELF, extremely low frequency ELF. This ELF penetrates deep into the earth and deep into the sea, which means that it could be used for communication and surveillance. It can be used to do something called earth penetrating tomography, which has been described as like CAT scanning the earth or a dirt radar. With the right equipment, the right people, in the right place, you can read the return of the ELF signals into the earth and see what's underground. And the project was originally funded by the United States Senate under counterproliferation studies to verify counterproliferation treaties, to spy on the Libyans and the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Koreans. The Navy got in on the project because they realized that if you can penetrate deep in the earth, you can also penetrate deep into the sea and communicate with deeply submerged submarines, which they have been using it for several years now. Now, there's another aspect of this, in that when you blow the molecules of the atmosphere apart, up at the very top of the atmosphere, because of the heating, you induce convection, and that forces you have created a plasma, an electrically charged gas that then goes out into space. And it goes out into space until it is stopped by the Earth's magnetic field. It reaches the magnetic lines of force within the magnetic field and gets caught between the magnetic lines of force and then spreads out as a shield. It is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system. It is a way of creating a radiation zone at the above the atmosphere that would destroy incoming ICBMs and space satellites. The most succinct description of HARP is from a Department of Defense DOD document that says, and I quote, "The heart of the program will be the development of a unique ionospheric heating capability to conduct the pioneering experiments required to adequately assess the potential for exploiting ionospheric enhancement technology for DOD purposes." If you can get around the bureaucraties, it basically it says that the purpose of HARP is to find out if it can weaponize the atmosphere.
Wow. Now, what kind of weather effects would that tool as a manipulation device offer somebody with bad intent?
Okay, now I mentioned that this is a patented event. The patent is that the first of 12 basic patents on the HARP project is included at the back of my book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon, The Conspiracy. And this patent was granted to Dr. Bernard Eastland, who he then reassigned to his boss, APTI. APTI was a wholly owned subsidiary of ARCO, the oil giant. And that patent is a 1987 patent. It was granted in 87, and the title is Method and Apparatus for Altering a Region of the Earth's Atmosphere, Ionosphere, and/or Magnetosphere. And in it, he discusses several different types, several different ways that weather could be directly affected by his array. Now, the patent calls for an array 40 miles on a side, where a HARP is only 1,000 feet on a side. So HARP is a great deal smaller than what is described in the patent. But it is the same technology. He describes being able, among other things, being able to move the jet stream. In, I think it was 1996, Popular Science magazine ran an article about HARP, in which they noted that there was, the previous year, there had been a dogleg in the jet stream immediately above the HARP website, or the HARP antenna field, which seems to have resulted in a cluster of rare tornadoes in Florida.
Now, I'm confused. How can the event in Alaska have an effect in Florida?
Well, it's the downstream. The atmosphere only seems local because you're standing in a spot. But in fact, the atmosphere is one immense system. It is all linked together. In fact, not only is the atmosphere linked together, but the atmosphere and the oceans are linked together. The atmosphere and the rainforest are linked together. There is a continual synergy between the Earth's many systems. And there is no such thing as local weather. It has been described that a butterfly could flap its wings in Peru, and 5 weeks later there could be a tornado in Kansas.
Jerry, this is Roy Ivy. I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sitting here listening. So if they have that kind of technology, and I don't know how accurate it is, but if there was a drought somewhere, why wouldn't they just say, well, you know, it hasn't rained over here in a while. The farmers need some water. Let's make it rain.
Well, I would submit to you that whoever has this technology, is operating it as clandestinely as possible due to fear of lawsuits. Two, is operating it from the top of the government down. Three, may be operating it privately. Just because we know about the HARP project doesn't mean it's the only one. Yes, it does have a patented ability to do yada yada, but that doesn't mean that there aren't dozens of other variations on the theme out there. And where I'm going with this is that over the last decade, Enron has been doing something very suspicious. Enron invented weather derivatives, basically betting on the weather. And Enron was $1 billion into weather derivatives. Enron bet $1 billion a year on whether the temperature was going to go up in summer or down in winter, because just a few degrees of fluctuation meant tremendous profits in energy sales.
So how did they do that?
I don't know if they did it or not, but you know the old thing is follow the money. And there is a fellow named Stevens who is a now retired TV weatherman who made quite a splash the last couple of years by being the most accurate TV weatherman. And he explained the reason he was accurate is because he threw out the NOAA models, NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and he ignored their models, he ignored the stuff the National Weather Service was giving him, and he was convinced that there was indeed something called scalar weaponry, that there were energy devices being used, and that they left patterns, they left visible markers, and that he used those visible markers to predict what the weather was going to be, and apparently he figured it out because he was dead on most of the time. He quit his job as a weatherman to go to full time maintaining his website and telling people about the ongoing weather wars a few months ago. And if you go to his website, Weather War, I think it's either Weather War or weatherwars.com, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Well, let's bring in the concept of sustainable development. Every time you mention Enron, I think of Ron Lay. He was the only business guy on President Clinton's Council for Sustainable Development back in 1993. And, you know, it's clear that company fell apart because it was engaged in all kinds of frivolous New World Order type financial plays that imploded when the new global governance system didn't take effect as quickly as Enron had planned. So there we go with another example of the bad dealing of that corporation. And once they're involved in something, understanding what the character of of that leadership was, you know, we can begin to open our minds to various kinds of possibilities that you suggest right here with that expose, Jerry.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's pretty much what I've been working on, is that there seem to be an awful lot of players in this thing, and there seem to be an awful lot of technology being worked about, and you know, you talk about this to the average Joe, and to him it sounds like pure science fiction. It sounds like you're talking about Star Trek or Star Wars. But in fact, we live in the future. We virtually everything that we learned in school is now as passe I went blank. I hate it when I go blank.
Well, it's like computers. You know, they used to be so big. Now they're on a little tiny thing where you have all that power.
The sum total of human knowledge has doubled during our life.
Well, I've heard it said that it's doubling every 10 years. So
yes, every 10 or 12.
Things are moving very quickly. We're going to be back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our guest, Jerry Smith. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm here with Roy Avila and our special guest, Mr. Jerry Smith, who's an author. Jerry, tell us your web site, jerrysmith.com.
jerryesmith.com, J-E-R-R-Y-E-S-M-I-T-H.com. You will find virtually everything I've been talking about on it. You have to do a little poking around. I have a page of ongoing research. At the top of the page, whenever you get to jerryesmith.com, at the top of the page you'll see the main menu. Click on books, and then click on ongoing research. And that will take you to all the articles I've found on this subject, and links to these articles. Or there are a number of websites that deal with this, and so I have a huge links library with something like 30,000 links, and I have them in the several pages on a variety of subjects, and one of which is harp and conspiracy. And so from the top of the page, click on links and then click on harp and scroll down the page, and we'll take you to the official harp website and to a number of websites both in favor of and opposed to harp, and a number of other subjects I'm tracking.
Now, are there people who still say that harp is a figment of some people's imagination, or is it pretty well reconciled by people in general that there's nothing make believe about the existence of harp?
Well, I suppose there are some people who might imagine it doesn't exist. And I saw a web poll the other day where the radio show The X Zone asked if the listeners thought the U.S. went to the moon or not, and 70,000 people clicked no, we didn't go to the moon. So there are some interesting people out there. If you want verification that HARP exists and don't feel like driving or flying to Alaska to find out, there are, you know, it has its own website. You just Google HARP, and the official HARP webpage usually is the first one to come up. There's also a good page in Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia on HARP. Most of the world assumes that if a bunch of professors tell us that this is what it is, then they assume, well, that's got to be what it is. And so the folks, HARP is most...
I don't know, Freedom 21, we all say, it depends on which payroll they're on.
Exactly. that's the deal. If HARP is on ground owned by the Department of Defense. The project was originally managed by a joint Air Force-Navy management team who got their management pulled a couple of years ago. The government wasn't liking what they were doing, and management was given to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The current program manager for HARP is a Dr. Sheldon Beth at DARPA in the TTO, the Tactical Office. I forget which T comes first. It's curious, the TTO's primary job is to find what they call force enhancers. Now, remember at the very beginning of the hour when we started talking, the first thing I mentioned was an Air Force white paper called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. And the TTO's job is to find force multipliers. And one of the things the TTO is doing is HARP, which clearly is a force multiplier. And what that phrase means is that you take something that jacks up the power of your military forces. For example, if you're going to launch an invasion against an enemy, if you could make all their spy satellites disappear, they wouldn't be able to see what your guys were doing, and so you could sneak in on them. So anything that would kill spy satellites would be a force multiplier. That's one of the things HARP can do.
You know, you talked about this kind of going on for quite a while. Are there any of the the scientists or ex-military people that have written on these kinds of things?
Only favorably, oddly enough. In mainstream press, you get almost no negative press. In fact, Project Censor...
Well, they're all on the take, that's all.
Well, Project Censor at Sonoma University listed Harp as one of the 20 underreported stories of 1994, and when they did the Millennium Update, they listed it as one of the 100 underreported stories of the century. Mother Jones magazine, also in that year, listed it as one of the most underreported stories of that year. It is known, and it just simply isn't being covered, and there are a number of reasons why it's not being covered. One, it doesn't do anything newsworthy. It just sits there. And two, it's in the middle of southwest nowhere, Alaska. I mean, there's no local angle because there's nobody there. The closest town is the thriving metropolis of Glen Allen, which nobody's ever heard of. So there just isn't any news stories about it. But, you know, once a year, they hold an open house, and they have professors, because most of the work is being done on the ground by students and professors from the University of Alaska. So once a year they hold an open house with punch and cookies, and the local folk go out, and maybe a reporter from Anchorage will go out and poke around. And that's about as much news as it generates.
Why? Now, let's jump to this big issue, and the big issue in the minds of people who might become concerned about the character of leadership in the United States would ask the question, well, could hurricanes or could earthquakes be modified?
Absolutely. We do know, in my book, Harp, the Ultimate Weapon, the Conspiracy, I give as much of the history of environmental modification as I can to show that it is an ongoing project. And frankly, it has been an ongoing thing for a very, very long time. You may remember there was an empire called Rome, and Rome was fighting the Carthaginians. And when Carthage lost, Rome salted the fields so they couldn't grow any crops. That's environmental modification for hostile purposes. You may remember in the 1840s in North America, the United States government decided that the Indians were a problem. And one of the ways they decided to solve the Indian problem is they realized that the Indians lived off the buffalo. So they hired people to go kill the buffalo. And they just about made the buffalo extinct. And they did succeed in just about making the Plains Indian extinct. Come Vietnam, they did the same thing. Agent Orange was a defoliant, and it wasn't used to trim the hedges. It was used to wipe out the jungle that the enemy lived in on the same premise that they wiped out the buffalo. This is nothing new, and there's no indication that it has stopped. The problem is that in recent years, the government has, particularly after Project Cirrus, has realized that they have a problem that if it gets out, they could get sued. They could have angry mothers marching around the sites where the technology is being developed, and so they've kept it under wraps as much as they can, and so you have to the last 20 years or so of weather modification probably has been an incredible jump in technology, because everything else has done an incredible jump in technology, particularly in like the last 5 years. I mean, we have things today that we were only guessing might exist 5 years ago that nobody had a clue would exist 20 years ago. I can't give you specifics because I cannot break through the code barrier to unearth the proofs. I'm sure they're there. I just don't know how to pull them out.
Do you have any knowledge of you know, you did talk about ARCO owning one of the patents, but any other companies becoming involved with the government on more patents or more kinds of developments of...
Yeah, there are a bunch. If you start Googling around, you'll find a few. Probably the biggest is Weather Modification Incorporated. Weather Modification Incorporated is a private company, and the one of the chief engineers for the company was one of the guys who worked on Project Popeye. And he was on Art Bell a couple of months ago, blowing the whistle on Hurricane Katrina and Rita, that he could see that they were manipulated, and telling Art's audience what he could see of the likely technologies being used to do that.
Well, that's disturbing.
Very, very disturbing. Looking at those events, what I'm thinking is going on is that there's one set of people who are working on jacking up hurricanes in their formative stages, and then there's another set of technology being used to move them around, and there may be several different players in this. From what I saw, Rita, it looked to me like Rita was started by Team A and then stopped right at the last moment by Team B, if you will. You remember, just as it was about to make landfall, it suddenly veered off target. It suddenly took a right turn. And I'm thinking that's, there's the question of, well, if there's a drought, why don't we make it rain? I think our guys finally figured out, oh my God, and moved it at the last moment. And considering how slow FEMA was to do anything meaningful, I see it as a hand in glove. The weather guys also were, you know, what do we do? We need orders. We need orders. We can't do anything until we got orders. My God, can somebody make a decision? I think that's a big piece. And of course, the average American has no clue what the heck FEMA is for. You know, FEMA's bit about hurricanes and disaster relief and flood and all this is just window dressing. Less than 5% of FEMA is spent on emergency, on weather or, you know, natural disaster type emergencies. The other 95% is COG, Contingency of Government. FEMA runs 140 plus underground installations. You remember September 11, 2001, the president disappeared for 4 hours. COG went into effect. The president ceased to be the president. He became simply a package. He was picked up and taken and stowed. He was stored. He was taken to the underground base underneath there in Kansas, Omaha. And he was stashed in Omaha for 4 hours. At the end of that, FEMA stood down and gave the president back his job.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners are aware of FEMA's role in regionalizing the domestic American countryside as an emergency step. We have a caller on the line, Roger from Pennsylvania. Roger, are you with us?
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. Yeah, I have no problem with the use of cloud seeding, which is like, 30, 40 years old, kind of conventional. I just doubted on a lot of these other things that man had enough megawatts at his disposal to pull off some of the things that are attributed to the heart. And I did read some of those highfalutin abstracts on the heart project and secondary way, acoustic and electromagnetic wave emissions from that, which seems to be pretty effective for disrupting the ionosphere just as far as radio communications. You mentioned the ELF waves going to ground, and according to Scott Stevens, who himself is quite the occultist, his term quantum realm, the thought has power in the quantum realm, prayer has power. We are all part of God. It sounds like a pantheism there. But then he acknowledged to me that there's not enough power there so much, so he used his term, requires pulling energy from space-time. So that does take it into that headier physics of Star Trek. And if you'd want to respond to that... Sure.
Let me say that when I started work on my book, Harp, there was one previous book that came out about 8 months before me. That was Dr. Nick Begich and Gene Manning did a book called Angels Don't Play With Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. And that book bounces all over the map and it looks at a bunch of different things. But at the time, Dr. Nick Begich was convinced that HARP was a ground-based Star Wars weapon system. Now, I look at the project, and I'm thinking, I've been researching mind control since 1976. So I've been researching mind control for 20 years. I run into HARP, and HARP is designed to bathe the entire world in ELF to do this earth-penetrating tomography, but the ELF is exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. And I realized, oh my God, if these guys have no clue what they're doing, if HARP is exactly what they say it is, if there's no covert, there's no black project, it's just what they say it is, it could be absolutely devastating. They could inadvertently, without having a clue they're doing it, create road rage across half the planet. And if they do know what they're doing, it could be the ultimate weapon because you could directly attack the minds of everybody on the planet, which is why it's called HARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. Now, Nick Begich and I have done an odd flip in the last 6 years. I am now convinced that HARP is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system, and Nick is convinced that HARP is a mind control device. We are both in regular communication with the inventor of the project, Dr. Bernard Eastland. I exchanged a couple of emails with Ben just earlier this week. Dr. Eastland, who wrote the patents that included the concept of being able to move the jet stream and do other weather manipulation with it, he's the one who says there's not enough power in it. His numbers say that HARP has to be able to output at least 100 billion watts, and it's currently designed to put out 3.6 billion watts. So it's the only way they could achieve weather control with HARP as it currently is if they pulsed the field. In pulsing the field, you might be able to jack it up from 3 billion to 300 billion. But that's very theoretical, and there's absolutely nothing in the hard copy. There's nothing in the official scientific papers that HARP has circulating that says anything about pulsing the field. We don't know whether they're doing it or not. We don't know whether they're considering doing it or not. I am very dubious about claims of HARP affecting the weather, but I have found at least 80 projects in the United States that are directly aimed at affecting the weather. I live in Reno, Nevada, where there is the Desert Research Institute. The DRI is involved in environmental and weather modification and manipulation and study all over the planet. They have hundreds of projects running up there at this very moment, including at this very moment, their cloud seeders are seeding the storm that's over the Sierra Nevadas as I speak. And they, last time I looked, the DOI has live weather cams, and during the day, you could actually watch the cloud seeders work.
Is that a governmental agency?
It's a department, yes, it's government, but it's an EDU government. It's a division of the, State of Nevada University System.
Oh, and is it a public-private partnership, maybe?
Yeah, you know, I have not been able to get any sort of coherent answers to questions like that. The DOI had an open house this summer, and I went up and I spoke briefly with the executive director, and he just sort of smiled and nodded, and I really couldn't get anything out of him.
Well, thank you for your call, Roger, and you got some
something to chew on from that response. We have another caller, Jerry, Jack from Michigan. Jack, are you with us?
Hi there.
Hi, Jack. What's your question?
Glad to be with you. I wanted to ask Jerry if he's had any communication with, I think he's a retired NASA scientist, Fred Bell. Fred Bell, and then there's Jay McCanney, Jay McCanney Science.
I'm familiar with Bell's name rings a bell, but I'm really bad with names and obviously with puns. McCanney, I'm familiar with. He's the guy who's pressing an alternative theory to what comets are.
Well, McCanney said that he has a technology that can totally disrupt. He said Katrina was totally fabricated, as did Fred Bell. And Fred Bell sent to George Norrie a communication wherein he stated that during that really large CME event, that the HARP installations, or perhaps space-based installations that Jay McCanney believes is responsible, whatever the system is, it punches holes, large holes in the magnetosphere and I guess the ionosphere. And as the CME proceeds through these holes, a vortex effect is created, which then can be enhanced and even directed by lasers. And a woman who called the show prior to the interview with James McCanney, who said, yeah, they're doing it with space-based lasers. They can target an area, and they can direct it wherever they want it to go. A woman called and said, gee, a funny thing happened in the earliest reports that my husband and I witnessed this. There were like these three laser beams coming down through the center of the storm.
Right, I actually have a photograph of those. I don't really know what to make because, you know, with Photoshop you can do anything these days. But it is really interesting. I do have a photo of ruby lasers into the waves. There's some very interesting photos that show strange anomalies. Katrina, for the last 12 hours before making landfall, had a square eye hole. There's a series of 8 official NOAA photographs with it having a square eye hole. Now that's got to be different.
Oh, that's weird. And the other thing, Jerry, is on the whatever it was, Discovery or History Channel, they're doing a thing on the Bermuda Triangle. They interviewed a bunch of people who had sailed across the Bermuda Triangle. One crew back in 2002 were out sailing around, I don't know, after dark over to the Bahamas, and all of a sudden they saw this ball of light, and it came right in their direction, and as it approached them maybe 500 yards away, it suddenly became a vortex, a spinning vortex right before their eyes. And these guys said, we were saying our prayers because we thought we were going to just disappear. This is their eyewitness account.
Well, I know almost nothing about what you're speaking, except that I've been really, I was real interested in stories of the triangle like 25 years ago, and I could probably dredge up a bunch. You mentioned the History Channel. My new book is Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny, History and Legend, and I'm going to be interviewed for a show on the History Channel on December 19th. I believe that's a Monday. The show, I gather, is a 2-hour documentary called Relics of the Passion. So thanks for giving me a chance to make a plug.
Well, thank you for calling, Jack, and thank you, Jerry, very much. We're just about wrapped up with our hour here tonight, and any final message you'd like to leave our audience with?
I'd like to invite your audience to visit my website, jerryesmith.com, jerryesmith.com. The book we've been discussing tonight is HARP, The Ultimate Weapon to Conspiracy. My new book is Secrets of the Holy Lance. You can buy both of them directly from me from my website and get autographed copies, and then you can get them at Barnes & Noble and so forth.
Well, good. I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight, and look forward to hearing more from you.
All right, thank you.
Well, have a good rest of the day. Good night now.
Good night.
And to our audience, tune back in next week. We're planning to run the War on Reason during the month of December. And we've, at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, just released a new pamphlet that you can check out on our website. That's f21sc.net for the new pamphlet called Transforming America, Sustainable Development, the Destruction of Your Rights, Creating Crisis, Shortage, and a Police State. Short, simple to read, and to the point. Don't miss your copy and spread it in your community. And long live freedom. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk with you soon. Good night.